from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Hazinu. During this holiday season, please mention the podcast to your friends and neighbors. Our listenership continues to grow with your help. Thank you very much. This week, Hazinu with Rabbi Meir Schweiger. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Hazinu. Today, I would like to examine the closing verses of the parsha, chapter 32, verses 48 to 52, the section which I call the tragic end of Moshe. Before we look at these verses, I think it's important to understand the significance of the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy. Dvarim are the parting words of Moshe to the Jewish people, the legacy which he leaves them with. Moshe's parting words are meant to prepare the Jewish people to not only conquer the land of Israel, not only to take possession of the land of Israel, but hopefully to remain there forever. Throughout the book of Dvarim, Moshe warns the people of the pitfalls of idolatry, of what we might call assimilating in the pagan culture. Moshe recalls, sums up, their history from the moment they left Egypt, going through the desert, receiving the Torah at Sinai, their moments of glory, and also their tragic sins, sins which caused the whole generation to die in the desert. And the purpose of doing all that is for the Jewish people to learn from their mistakes so that they don't repeat them, so that they don't bring upon themselves further tragedies. In Parshat Ki Tavoh, Parshat Nitzavim, Moshe brings the new generation into a covenantal relationship with God. Not only are they brought into that covenantal relationship, but as it says in the beginning of Parshat Nitzavim, the covenant is being made with all generations to come, whoever is not here today. And as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, it's a covenant which is being made with every single individual. In the beginning of our Parsha, Moshe is told by God to teach the Jewish people a song which is in effect speaking about how God operates in history, which is looking at the past, foreshadowing the future. I can't really say that it's a happy song, because in fact it speaks about how the Jewish people will become corrupted, how the Jewish people will reject God, how the Jewish people will become like Sodom and Amorah, which is also echoed in Parshat Nitzavim. The purpose of this song is so that the Jewish people not fall into that pitfall. And if they do, to understand why these things, why the tragedies are happening to them. This brings us to the closing verses. After Moshe has brought the Jewish people, the new generation, into a covenantal relationship with God, after he's taught them this song which they are to carry with them, to remind them of how God is very much involved in the events that govern their lives, God then tells Moshe in the closing verses, go up to Har Nebo, Mount Nebo, what I would call this mountain of transition. Moshe is to go up to this mountain because this is the place where he will die. Moshe will die on this mountain in the same way that Aaron went up another mountain, Hor HaHar, and also was laid to rest. God says to Moshe, from this mountain, you will see that land which I am giving to the Jewish people, giving them as their eternal possession, but you will not come to that land. You will not enter that land. And in verse 51, the reason which is given for why not only Moshe does not enter the land, but why Aaron also did not enter the land, is that Asher ma'altem bi, you betrayed me. You acted treacherously to me in the midst of the Jewish people by the waters of Meribah in the desert of Tzin. You did not sanctify me in the midst of the Jewish people. This verse echoes another verse, which appears in real time at this incident of Me Merivah, where the Jewish people complain because they have no water, and where God tells Moshe, take a stick and go talk to this rock, and the rock will bring forth its waters, and you will be able to provide water for the whole congregation and their flocks. And somehow things get messed up. And although Moshe succeeds in bringing forth water, it seems that God is very upset with Moshe and Aaron. And this is the book of Numbers, chapter 20, verse 12. God said to Moshe and Aaron, because you did not have faith in me to sanctify me before the eyes of the Jewish people, therefore you will not bring this congregation to the land which I have given them. You did not have faith in me. In our verse, in our parasha, instead of you did not have faith in me, you acted treacherously. You betrayed me. But in both verses, it says that they did not sanctify God before the eyes of the Jewish people. It is not at all clear from that section what is it that Moshe and Aaron did wrong. And in fact, if you were to go through medieval commentaries, early rabbinic commentaries, you will discover probably at least 15 to 20 explanations of what it was exactly that they did wrong. And I'm not interested today in going into all those explanations. What I am interested in talking about is the punishment, which does not seem to be commensurate with the crime. And what do I mean by that? If I look back at the beginning of Exodus, the beginning of the book of Shemot, when God first gives Moshe his mission, which is overwhelming, he needs to negotiate with Pharaoh to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, which in and of itself would seem to be an impossible task. But beyond that, once they leave Egypt, his job is to bring them into the land of Israel. And if we were to look back, we would see how Moshe, after his initial hesitations, takes on this dual role in the most commendable way possible. He stands up to Pharaoh. He is a model of leadership. And once the Jewish people leave Egypt, he takes them for 40 years through the desert, patiently, having to deal with dissension, with complaints. It is mind-boggling. Ultimately, the crowning point of his leadership is to bring the Jewish people into the land of Israel. And yet it seems to be that at the very last moment, God snatches that from him and Aaron. After all the hard work which they put in to bringing the Jewish people to the land. And here we're speaking especially about Moshe. Here is Moshe, who brings them to the cusp of the land of Israel and is told, you can see the land, but you can't go in. You have to die in the desert. And as I said, whatever Moshe may have done, it seems that the punishment is far in excess to the crime. It is very interesting that at the beginning of our parsha, there is a verse which is very much relevant to Moshe, although it seems to be directed to the Jewish people. This is chapter 32 in our parsha, verse 4. Hatzur tamim pa'olo, the rock. His actions are, one could say, perfect, complete. Ki chol drachav mishpat, all of his ways are just. El emunah, a faithful God, ve'ein avel, and no perversion, distortion. Tzadik v'yasharhu, God is righteous and straight. We could say straightforward. And then the next verse says, shichet lo, which I will translate. Is corruption his? Lo. No, banav mumam. The blemish is in his sons. Dor ikesh ufetaltol. a stubborn generation, a convoluted one. This verse has been seen by the rabbis from the time of the Talmud to this very day as dealing with the question of theodicy, which means how do we somehow deal with bad things that happen to good people. The verse itself seems to be talking about something that may happen in the future when the Jewish people, as a people, are punished. And then issues are raised with how could God do such a thing? And in effect, what the verse is saying is what's called in Hebrew tzidduk hadin. It's somehow acknowledging the justice of what is happening, justifying it, as a way of saying, despite what happened, God is just, God is fair. In another podcast, I had mentioned the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who saw this as an allusion to the generation of the Second Temple, I should say more specifically, the destruction of the Second Temple, where the question was raised, why was the temple being destroyed? Why were the Jewish people being exiled? If during the Second Temple period, the Jews were actually behaving much better than the First Temple period. If in the First Temple period, the Jewish people had committed what we would call the cardinal sins of Judaism, murder, idolatry, sexual immorality. In the Second Temple period, that wasn't happening. As I mentioned then, the Second Temple period was the time of the rise of Rabbinic Judaism, the study of Torah, was really beginning to take off, the oral law. And the Netziv basically says that despite the fact that they were righteous, tzaddikim, they weren't yashar. And essentially what he says is the reason why the Second Temple period was destroyed, why the Second Temple was destroyed, is because of the polarization within the Jewish people that actually, in his language, came to bloodshed, with the tendency of one group demonizing another group. If I come back to our topic, but this verse, which appears at the beginning of the parsha, also seems to be directed towards the end of the parsha. How is it that God is punishing Moshe so severely? And the answer in the verse is, God is righteous. God is straight. All of his paths are just. All of his actions are complete. God is faithful. I would like to just focus on a few things and then also speak about the sheet which I attached. In this verse, chapter 32, verse 4, God is described as a rock and the image of a tzur, a rock which is unchanging, which is not eroded, which will stand firm no matter what. And I will say, unfortunately, quote unquote, this was reflected with Moshe and Aaron. And we actually see this with Moshe in a very poignant way. In the beginning of Parshat Va'etchanan, in the book of Dvarim, this is Dvarim, chapter 3, verse 23, where Moshe says, and I pleaded with God, and I said to God, you have begun to show me, your servant, your greatness, your power. In that, Moshe actually began what could be called the conquest of the land of Israel in chapter 21 in the book of Numbers, when he defeated two kings, Sihon and Og, who were on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And then Moshe says to God, let me pass through. Let me see this good land, the good mountain. And in verse 26, Moshe says, and God became angry with him because for the sake of the Jews, God did not listen to him. God said to Moshe, enough, you've spoken too much. Don't speak to me anymore about this matter. Go up to the top of the mountain and see the land because you will not cross it. Yoshua will be the one to bring the Jewish people into the land. God is unbending. When God said, Moshe will not enter the land, and this seems to be the theme from chapter 20 in the book of Numbers, God will not bend. No matter how much Moshe prays, no matter how much Moshe pleads, no matter what arguments Moshe brings, as a way of saying, perhaps there's some opening which can now let me slip through. God is adamant, determined, that Moshe cannot come in. So how do we understand this? And the truth is that I don't think I'm going to actually give an explanation which is satisfying, but at least as an attempt to try to get a handle on this. And I would like to now shift to the sheet which I attached to this podcast. In the Talmud, in Masechet Yomah, and this podcast is actually being put up before Yom Kippur, so that what I'm saying, I think, is very much appropriate in the spirit of Yom Kippur. The Talmud speaks about four different types of sins and how atonement is achieved. And the Talmud says, first of all, to achieve atonement, there's no question that a person has to repent, to do tshuva. This is reference number one, Masechet Yomah, Yomah 86a. If one transgresses a positive commandment and repents, they are forgiven. If it was a prohibition, repentance is not enough. But we need the day of Yom Kippur in order to achieve atonement. If it is a sin where the punishment is the death penalty, then you also need suffering to somehow bring about the atonement. And then at the very end, which I have in bold print, but if somebody has been guilty of the profanation of the name, then although I have repentance, and I have Yom Kippur, and I have suffering, nevertheless, atonement only occurs upon death. Which is in effect saying that the most serious sin, in a way, which a person can do, is the desecration of God's name. And for the desecration of God's name, there is no forgiveness until the day the person dies. Death is the atonement. And then when we look at the continuation of that Gemara, it says, what constitutes profanation of the divine name? And then I have a number of different rabbis who give examples of what is called profaning the divine name, all of which seem to be relatively innocuous. And once again, it raises the question, this is desecration of the divine name where only death can bring about the final atonement? What I would like to do now is to jump to the Rambam, Maimonides. This is Maimonides from the Mishneh Torah, what's called Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the laws of the fundamental principles of the Torah. And in this section, Maimonides talks about how the Jewish people are commanded to sanctify God's name. And now what we're looking at is chapter 5, Halakha 11. There are other deeds which are also included in the category of the desecration of God's name. If performed by a person of great Torah stature, who is renowned for his piety, deeds which, although they are not transgressions, will cause people to speak disparagingly of him. Maimonides, in effect, is taking what appeared in the Talmud and then putting it in his own words, and then is making a statement which is a very, very powerful statement. Desecration of God's name does not happen, just when people do terrible things. Depending on who the person is, and not only that, the greater the person is, the closer the person is to God, the greater is the capacity for desecrating God's name. Why is that? We all know that people look to their leaders as models, role models that should be emulated. And even when leaders do things which for the average person would seem to be, as I said, innocuous, the public judges their leaders by a much harsher standard. They expect their leaders to be impeccable in their behavior. And what is true in the human realm is certainly true in the divine realm. If we talk about leaders who are not just leaders, but who in a very profound way are the embodiment of the Torah, are the living Torah, who by example, not only by teaching, set the standard, what happens when they don't live up to that standard. And in effect, what we see from the Talmud and what we see from Maimonides is that those leaders, those Torah scholars, are not exonerated from guilt. If anything, God is much more demanding and much less tolerant of mistakes which they make, and comes down much harder on those leaders because of the impact of their behavior on the community at large. Why is it that the atonement for desecration of God's name only happens when the person dies? And now I want to apply it to the story of Moshe. When Moshe dies for the sin that he did, the message which is being told to the people is that nobody is above the law. Everyone is accountable for what they do. And sometimes leaders pay a very, very heavy price for mistakes they make because of the impact that will have on the people they're leading. Moshe's tragedy is that he's not able to bring his mission to its final conclusion. His tragedy is that he himself is not able to come to the promised land, even as a private citizen. His legacy does not fall apart because Joshua does bring them into the land. His legacy does not fall apart because the Torah continues to be taught and perpetuated to this very day. But he personally does not, quote unquote, reap the benefits of his labor. Something for us to think about, and I'll leave you with this thought because, as I said, this podcast will be put up before Yom Kippur, is how when we do things, we always have to ask ourselves the question, is what I am doing in the end going to be a sanctification of God's name or a desecration of God's name? It's not enough for us to just be good, average people, but it means each of us, depending on the context we find ourselves in, has to ask ourselves, not only is what I'm doing okay, but how will that impact on the people around me? For people who are rabbis, who are educators, whatever they do in the context of their congregation or their classes is picked up by the people who are their followers, for good and bad. Your average Jew, how is what they do seen by the non-Jewish world? To what extent is it that what that average Jew is doing is a positive or negative reflection on the Jewish people as a whole? I realize that this is what we would call very heavy duty. But at the same time, I think one of the things which is important to think about is, as it says in our parsha, before we blame God for being excessive, for being unjust, and raising all those issues of theodicy, we have to really look at ourselves and say to ourselves, perhaps the fault lies with us. Perhaps we did something which we may think is innocuous, but we don't realize the damage, the ramifications of small things. What today in the world of physics would be called the butterfly effect. May we do our soul searching during this period before Yom Kippur, and I would say even after Yom Kippur, and always ask ourselves the question, is what we are doing a sanctification of God's name, a desecration of God's name? May we be mindful in all that we do, and may we ultimately, through this introspection, bring about a much better world, which invites the presence of God to dwell in, where all of humanity will come to acknowledge not only the one God, but the unity of all of humanity. Gmar Chatima Tova, Shana Tova, and may we all be blessed by being inscribed in the Book of Life, to choose life, to choose a life which will sanctify God and bring about greater unity among the Jewish people.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.